So this morning, I thought to start with some meditation on some of the points that I was talking about yesterday that we didn't have a chance to meditate on. So make yourselves comfortable. Try to sit with your back straight, if that's possible, because that helps the mind to be more awake and alert and focused. But let your shoulders relax. Don't have them tight and tense. And in fact, try to have the whole of your body as relaxed as possible. If there is any tension anywhere in your body, see if you can let it go. You could imagine it melting and flowing out of you, draining out of you, and going down into the earth below, disappearing there. Or imagine that it evaporates and disappears in space. So do the best you can to let go of tension in your body. But don't worry if you're not able to do that completely, if there's still some remaining spots of tension here and there. Just let them be. Feel content that you did the best you can to let go of tension. And then let go of any thoughts there may be in your mind of the past or the future or other places, your work, your problems, your worries. So put them aside for now. You can pick them up again later if you wish to. But try for now to put everything else aside and just let your mind be in the present, right here, right now. And being aware of the breath coming in and going out is a good way to be in the present because our breath is happening in the present. It's not in the past or in the future or some other place. It's right here, right now. So when our mind is observing the breath, being aware of the breath coming in and going out, then naturally our mind is in the present. And any time you notice that your mind has wandered away from the breath to something else, just gently let go of that other object, disengage from that other object, and come back to the breath. And now to ensure that what we are doing here this morning will be as beneficial as possible, not only to ourselves, but also to others, let's see if we can generate a positive, altruistic intention or motivation for being here. And so that could be bodhicitta, the aspiration to become fully enlightened, to help all living beings. So if you're comfortable and familiar with that motivation, you can bring that into your mind. Otherwise, altruistic motivation that might be easier for many people would be simply wanting to be as helpful as you can to other people, to try to avoid doing anything harmful, disturbing, problematic for others, and instead trying to help them as much as you can. So you could think your reason for being here is to learn ways in which you can be more helpful to others and avoid harming them, causing them problems. Okay, so now let's briefly contemplate the points of the death meditation, the 9-point meditation on death that we looked at yesterday. So we won't go through every one of the 9 points, but just the essential points, just to remind ourselves of them and see how they could be helpful for us in our life and in preparing for death and helping others who are dying. So first of all, let's contemplate how death is something definite. Even though we don't want it to happen, nobody wants to die, but just because we don't want it to happen doesn't mean we can stop it from happening. So it is definitely going to happen to us and to everyone else. And the more we contemplate that and get used to that idea, the more we get familiar with it and start to be comfortable with it. So just spend a few minutes contemplating that and seeing if you can just come to an acceptance that death is a reality. It's something we all will have to experience one day. And in case anyone feels uneasy, unhappy, frightened about the idea of all of us dying, just think that it's part of nature. It's the natural course of things. everything in the world, animate and inanimate, has its time. It comes into existence, it lasts for a while, then it goes out of existence. So it's just a natural phenomena. And it's much better if we can accept it rather than ignore it, deny it, you know, try to hope that it will never happen, because that's just not realistic and doesn't help. And then let's now contemplate how, even though it's definite that we're going to die, it's not sure when that will happen. Human beings do not have a fixed lifespan. Everyone lives to a certain age and then they die. But people die at all different ages and stages of life, some when they're infants, some when they're children, some as teenagers, some as young adults in their 20s and 30s and so on. Some live to be very old, in their 90s or even more than 100. So we cannot be sure what age we will be when death happens to us. And one reason for this is because there's different ways that death can happen. It can happen due to sickness, different kinds of diseases that can cause death. But there are also accidents that can happen just in the course of our daily life, whether we're traveling in a vehicle, or even if we're just walking or riding on a bicycle. Something could happen that could cause us to die. So I think naturally, instinctively, we hope that we will live a long time and that death won't come anytime soon, but we can't be sure of that. In reality, death could happen anytime. It could even happen to us this year or this month or even today. So when we become aware of that, we probably feel a sense of urgency as to what can we do to prepare ourselves for death. So the usual things we turn to for help when we're facing difficulties may not be able to help us at the time of death. For example, family and friends. So we turn to them for help during our life when we have problems, but it's not definite they will be around when death happens to us. So they may not be there to give us help and comfort. even if they are there, like if we're in a hospital and they're sitting and standing around us, but as we die, we lose our ability to see and hear and communicate with the outside world, and our mind goes deeper into itself, to deeper levels of itself. So then we're on our own, and nobody can go with us, even someone who loves us totally and unconditionally. They cannot go with us when we pass from this life to the next. So when we die, we leave behind all our loved ones, family, friends, pets. We also leave behind our home and possessions and money, wealth. We can't take any of that with us. And we also leave behind our body. That's been our constant companion every second of our life. But that too is left behind. The only thing that continues, that goes from this life to the next, is our mind, imprinted with the seeds of whatever actions we've done with our body, speech, and mind. In other words, our karma. So just the mind and its karmic imprints goes from this life to the next. And depending on the karmic imprints, whether they're more positive, virtuous ones, or more negative, non-virtuous ones, that will determine the kind of experiences that we have after death, in the intermediate state between this life and the next, and also our next life, where we are born, what kind of circumstances we're born into, the kind of experiences we have, and so on. So naturally, we want good experiences and not bad ones. So it's up to us to create the causes for good experiences and try to avoid creating the causes for bad experiences. So basically that means doing good and avoiding bad as much as we can during our life. Living ethically, trying to be as helpful as we can to others, trying to avoid harming others as much as we can, trying to work on our mind so that we have more positive states of mind, fewer negative ones. So as we saw yesterday, the state of mind we have at the time of death is very important, very crucial for determining what our future life will be. We should try to die with a positive state of mind, such as love, compassion, faith, devotion to objects of refuge. So to be able to have such a positive state of mind at that time, we need to train ourselves now in how to have positive states of mind and avoid negative ones. So I mentioned one practice that can be used when we have problems, difficulties. It's a practice of transforming suffering or problems into the spiritual path. So let's do a little bit of that practice now so you get an idea of how to do it. So we'll use a problem that we are currently having in our life. You don't have to think of a really huge problem, but you could think of a small one. For example, right now you might be feeling some discomfort in your body, some ache or pain or tiredness or hunger, thirst, heat, cold. So if there's some physical problem, physical discomfort in your body at this moment, you could use that. Or you could use some mental problem. Maybe you're feeling annoyed or irritated, unhappy about something, upset about something, worried about something. So choose one problem. You may have many problems, but just choose one for now. Focus your mind on that problem, but try not to get all caught up in it, overwhelmed by it. Instead, see if you can take a step back from it so that you can look at it objectively. And acknowledge that it is uncomfortable, unpleasant. It's a kind of suffering, an experience of suffering, like the Buddha spoke about in his first teaching, the truth of suffering. So this is suffering. It's unpleasant, unsatisfying. But remember that you're not the only person in the world who has suffering, who has problems. Everybody has. Even people who look like they're doing really well, they might look happy most of the time, and they may look like they have a lot of money, a lot of wealth, and they're very successful. So it appears as if everything is going well for them. But probably if you sat down and had a heart-to-heart talk with that person, they would start telling you about problems that they've had or problems that they are having at the present time. So we shouldn't be fooled by appearances. Even people who may look happy and well-to-do, they have problems too. Everybody has problems. And there are people who have the same kind of problem that you are having. This physical or mental, emotional problem that's bothering you right now. So lots of other people have a problem like this. And some may have it even worse than you do. Try to imagine someone or some people who have an even worse case of this problem than what you are experiencing. So this gives you an opportunity to feel compassion, because you know what it's like to have that problem. You know how unpleasant it is. So you can understand what it's like for those other people, how it's unpleasant for them too. And that can give rise to compassion. Compassion is wishing others to be free of their problems, their suffering. Wishing that they didn't have to have those problems, that they could be free from them. So that feeling might just come up in your mind naturally. But if it doesn't, you could just say to yourself words that express that wish. You could just say to yourself something like, how nice it would be, how wonderful it would be if everyone could be free of this problem. Nobody had to experience it. then see if you can go one step further and decide that you will accept the problem that you are having in order that all of those other people will be free of theirs. So you could say that to yourself, such as, by my accepting and experiencing this problem, may everyone else who has it be free. Or you could say, I will experience this problem on behalf of others so that they can be free, don't have to experience this problem. So that's actually a simple version of Tonglen practice, taking and giving practice, you've probably heard about. There's very elaborate ways of doing Tonglen where you actually imagine taking the suffering of others into yourself in the form of smoke or fog, and then sending out your happiness to them in the form of beautiful, brilliant light. So that's a kind of full version of Tonglen practice, but what we just did now is a simple version where you, whenever you're experiencing some problem or difficulty, you just think to yourself, by my experiencing this, may everyone else be free of their suffering, their problem. So once you learn how to do it, it's something you can do just in a couple of minutes or even 1 minute. And so it's something you could do in your daily life whenever you're having a problem. You just pause for a moment and then imagine, okay, other people have this kind of problem too. How nice it would be if they could be free. By my experiencing this, going through this, may they be free. So it's quite helpful. It's a way of transforming suffering into the spiritual path. And that was one of the points we looked at yesterday under the four tasks of living and dying from Christine Longacre's book, which is called Facing Death and Finding Hope, a really excellent book for all of us, both in terms of how we can prepare for our own death, but also help others who are dying. So one of those four tasks was learning how to understand and transform suffering, learning how to deal with suffering in a wise and skillful way. Because if we can do that during our life, as we're going through life, with the various problems and difficulties we face, then we have experience of that, we're familiar with that, and then when it comes to the end of our life, where we'll probably have some big suffering, difficult experiences, we'll already know how to deal with them in a wise and skillful way. Okay, so that's one, what we just did was one practice. Simple, relatively simple practice that you could do. But there's lots of other practices as well. And I mentioned a book called No Mud, No Lotus by Thich Nhat Hanh, The Art of Transforming Suffering. So there's a lot of very useful advice in there on how to transform suffering. Okay, so today we're going to go on and look at how to help others who are dying. So I have a few things to share with you with regarding that, and then there should be some time at the end if you have questions. So I think we will all find ourselves in this situation of somebody we know, family members, friends, colleagues, and so on, who are dying, who died before we do. And it's natural that because of our close connection with that person and our love for that person, we want to help them. We'd like to give them help and comfort at that time. And but sometimes, you know, people don't know what to do, what to say, and so on. So there's actually a very good book. It's also in this in the recommended reading list at the back of this. It's called "I Don't Know What to Say." And it was written quite a while ago, but I think it's still relevant. The author is a doctor, Canadian doctor named Robert Buckman. And at the time of writing this book, he had had about 25 years of experience working in hospitals. So he'd seen a lot of death, a lot of dying people, and was quite familiar with that whole situation. And he said one day he noticed somebody sitting in the waiting room of the hospital, and this person was looking kind of sad and confused, and so he approached him and, you know, asked if he needed help. And it turns out this person sitting in the waiting room had come to the hospital to visit somebody that he knew who was terminally ill. But this person was hesitant to go into the room and visit this person because he said, "I don't know what to say." Yeah? So I think this is a typical problem. You know, it's like we're used to talking to each other, having conversations with each other, but we're not so accustomed to having a conversation with somebody who's terminally ill, who's dying. Yeah, so you want to say the right thing and not the wrong thing. So it's difficult to know, what do I say? So that's why this doctor wrote this book. He's sort of explaining what it's like for the person who's terminally ill and dying, and kind of what kind of emotions they're going through, what kind of thoughts are happening in their mind, what is helpful to say, what's not helpful to say to such a person. So it's a very helpful book if, you know, if you find yourself in that situation. Anyway, from the Buddhist point of view, the most important thing with regard to helping somebody else who's dying is to try to help the person have a positive state of mind. So that's something we looked at yesterday. And this isn't just Buddhism, I think it's universal. I think all religions and spiritual traditions would agree with this, that when someone is dying, it's best if their mind can be calm and peaceful and positive and, you know, in some kind of virtuous state, not full of anger and fear and sadness and so on. Okay, so I think, you know, all religions would agree with that. So that's the ideal. That's the sort of goal or aim, is to help that person to have a positive state of mind. But we also have to be realistic, because it isn't possible for one person to change somebody else's mind. Even the Buddha can't do that. Yeah, you probably heard the story of this cousin of the Buddha named Devadatta, who was one of Buddha's disciples. He was a monk living in the community with the Buddha, but he was so negative. He had jealousy towards the Buddha, and, you know, couldn't see any good qualities in the Buddha, and, you know, he caused all kinds of problems. So even though he was living right there with the Buddha, but the Buddha wasn't able to change his mind. he continued having these negative thoughts and attitudes. He even tried to kill the Buddha a couple of times, so he was really negative. So it's just not possible, even if we were Buddha, to be able to change a person's mind and make them have a positive state of mind. So it's important to understand that, to accept that, that we do have limitations. So all we can do is try, okay? But if we're not able to change the person's mind, we shouldn't blame ourselves or feel bad. Because I met a woman once who told me that a friend of hers had been diagnosed with cancer, and he became really, really angry. He was angry at the doctors because he thought they should have detected it earlier when, you know, there was a chance of curing it, but they didn't, so now it was sort of too late to cure the cancer, and he was dying. So she tried to help him not be angry, but it didn't work. He continued being angry right up until the end. And she felt really bad, really sad about that. But I said to her, you know, you can't change somebody else's mind. Yeah, so it's not your fault. You shouldn't blame yourself. You shouldn't feel bad. But of course, naturally, you know, it's hard not to feel that way, because we do want that person who's dying to be in a good state of mind. So that's only natural. But it is important to accept our limitations. And this is what I do to myself. I said, even if I was a Buddha, I wouldn't be able to go into that person's mind and fix their mind and make them have positive thoughts. So I'm not a Buddha. So how can I expect myself to do that? Yeah. So that's important too. Still, it's worth trying. We try to help the person have a state of mind. And in fact, my teacher, Lama Zopa Rinpoche, said this is, you know, one of the greatest acts of kindness and generosity that we can do, is to help a person die well. Yeah, I mean, of course, it's good to give gifts to people and be kind to people during their life and so on. But the moment of death, the last time of their life before they die, that's a very important time, a very crucial time. So if we can help that person be in a good state of mind, a positive state of mind, that's a really, really good thing to do, a great act of kindness. So here are some things we can do. First is prepare yourself to So that's why, you know, I started off yesterday talking about how we can prepare ourselves for death. Because if we never do anything to prepare for death, how will we know how to help somebody else who's dying? Especially if we have attitudes like fear of death or the wish to avoid and deny the reality of death and attachment and so on and so forth. So if our mind is still kind of caught up in unrealistic or unhelpful or even negative attitudes with regard to death and dying, then that will hinder our ability to help somebody else, right? That makes sense? So on the other hand, if we follow, you know, the guidelines mentioned yesterday about preparing for our own death, even if we can't do all of them, but at least some of them, if we can just work on having more realistic and helpful attitudes about death and dying, then we'll be better able to help another person when they are dying. And then secondly is learn to manage disturbing emotions, because in Buddhism, we have a lot of information about disturbing emotions, which are sometimes called delusions or afflictions, afflictive emotions, klesha. There's lots of different terms used for these, but we all have them. They include things like anger and attachment, greed, craving, jealousy, fear, depression, and so on. So there's a whole range of emotions that arise in human minds, not just human beings, animals too. I remember once reading an article that some scientists wonder if animals have emotions or not. And I thought, well, if you live with an animal, you can see very clearly that they have emotions too. Because I used to have lots of cats when I was living here in Singapore, and they definitely exhibit jealousy and attachment and anger and fear and so on. So, yeah, animals have emotions too. But anyway, we're human beings and we're mostly dealing with human beings. So, as human beings, as unenlightened beings, then we have these disturbing emotions in our mind, and they can just pop up anytime without warning, and then our mind can get all caught up in and carried away and disturbed by these emotions. So a big part of Buddhist practice is learning how to work with or manage disturbing emotions. And this is important for us in our life, because if we don't know how to manage them, they can come up, especially in relationships with other people, and they can lead to all kinds of suffering and problems and terrible things, as well as health. Yeah, it's also found that like anger, for example, is very bad for us, bad for our health, our life, our ability to live long, and so on. So just for ourselves and being able to get by in life and in our relationships with others, then it's important to learn how to manage our disturbing emotions. But when it comes to being able to help others when they are dying, this is also very important, because if we haven't learned to manage our emotions, then when we're with a person who's dying, our emotions might come up, and we could get, in a state of turmoil. And if we are, caught up in disturbing emotions, that will impede our ability to help the other person. Yeah, for example, fear, a common emotion that could come up would be fear of death. So if we haven't learned how to work with and manage fear, when we're with the person who's dying, we might be in a state of fear. So, and, emotions are contagious, right? When one person is in a certain emotional state, then it can trigger the other person. So if we're, fearful and anxious, that could make the other person fearful and anxious. And that's not helpful. We want to be able to help them to calm down. And anger as well, if we can't manage our anger and we get angry in their presence, then there's a good chance that they will also get angry. So does that make sense, how important it is to learn how to work with and manage our emotions to be able to help the other person to, remain calm? But I don't think that means we have to be totally, having learned being totally beyond disturbing emotions, that's too much to expect, because you have to be at a really high state of spiritual development. But at least try to avoid exhibiting disturbing emotions when you're with a person. So if you do feel anger coming up or whatever, maybe you could excuse yourself, go off somewhere, and work on it. So that you're not just pouring it all out in their presence. I've heard that people who do hospice volunteer work, who volunteer to go and be with dying people, that they are advised to leave their baggage outside the door, something like that. Like, you may have emotional problems in your life, but don't carry those into your meeting with the dying person, because you're there to help them, right? That's the idea, is to be helpful to that person and not to use that person as a sounding board for all your complaints and your problems and so on and so forth. So leave your stuff outside the door. But of course, that doesn't mean we should suppress our emotions and avoid them, but try to find some other way of dealing with them, of working with them. We talk to friends or therapists or whatever. Find a way that you are managing and working with your disturbing emotions so that you're not burdening the dying person with your problems. So a regular practice of mindfulness is really helpful for working with disturbing emotions. Just being mindful that they are there, but that they are transitory, temporary, like clouds coming and going in the sky. So you can just notice the emotion and then let it go and not get all caught up in it. And not identifying with disturbing emotions is also really helpful. Normally we identify with our disturbing emotions, so when anger comes up, we immediately feel, I am angry. So we get totally identified with it. But emotions are not who we are. They are just transient mental states, transient states of mind, like clouds in the sky that come and go. So Buddhism said, our mind, the real nature of our mind is like the sky. It's clear and vast and spacious. And then thoughts and emotions are like clouds that pass through. They come and they go. They're not always there. They're not permanent. And they are not who we are. So it's really helpful to develop the habit of, when you do notice a disturbing emotion in the mind, to simply say something like that. There is that in my mind. There is anger in my mind. There is fear in my mind. There is jealousy in my mind. Rather than, I am angry, I am fearful, I am jealous. So just mentally verbalizing that is really, really helpful, because it just gives you some space, some distance, some objectivity with regard to that emotion, rather than being totally caught up in it, overwhelmed by it. So that's a useful tool for working with any kind of disturbing emotions. But then there's also specific tools or methods for specific emotions. For example, anger. There's whole books dealing with anger and how to work with anger. So if that is a big problem that you have, then it might be good to do further reading, research about working with that. And also, if you're most important caregiver, the main caregiver of someone who is dying, and if, you know, this care goes on for quite a bit of time, then you really need to be careful and look out for yourself, look after yourself, because it can be very exhausting physically and emotionally, looking after someone who's ill, someone who's dying, and so on. And I don't know how it is here in Singapore, but in some countries, the government will offer help, people who can come in and give the caregiver a break. Come in and look after the ill person or the dying person so that the caregiver isn't on duty 24 hours a day. So does that happen here? I see some people nodding and some people shaking their heads. So anyway, that's for you to look into. If there is... Or just on your own, try to find other family members or friends who can come in and help. So you have like a rotating group of people to take care of. Because people sometimes, you may feel, oh, it's my responsibility, it's my mother or my father, my wife, my husband, so I'm responsible. But then, you know, you might put too much burden on yourself and end up burning out. And then that can also, it's bad for your health, but also emotionally, it will become harder to manage your emotions. There's this expression called compassion fatigue, compassion burnout, which happens especially to caregivers and people in the helping professions, doctors, nurses, psychologists who are dealing with a lot of suffering for, you know, much of their time. And it is difficult. It is challenging. It is exhausting. So you need to be careful and try to avoid that happening, because if you do end up burning out, then you won't be able to help anymore. Yeah. So if you do want to continue helping, you know, as long as you are needed, you do have to take care of yourself. And that's not wrong to do. Don't feel it's wrong for you to take a break and do something to take care of yourself. Because if you can take care of yourself, then you'll have more energy and more positive emotions to be able to bring to your help for the dying person. Okay, then the next one is giving hope and finding forgiveness. So this is actually mentioned in a book called The Tibetan Book of Living and Dying, which is a really helpful book on both helping ourselves prepare for death and also helping others who are dying. So the point is, when someone is dying, they can sometimes experience difficult emotions such as guilt, regret, depression, a sense of hopelessness. People sometimes look back over their life and they think, oh, I did so many bad things, or I didn't do anything worthwhile, what a waste of time, you know? So they can, you know, become depressed and in despair about their life and have a hopelessness. Or they may feel really guilty about negative things that they've done, and then fearful about what will happen next, you know. Will I go to hell? Will God punish me? Will Buddha punish me? And so on and so forth. So, you know, if they have those kinds of thoughts and emotions coming up, then, you know, it's very hard for them to have a positive state of mind when they're dying. So, so if this is happening with a dying person, it's good to let them express their feelings. Don't say, oh, don't talk like that. You know, don't say that. Let them express what's on their mind, but speak to them in a way that would help them to change that state of mind. For example, if they're afraid that, if they're a Christian or a believer in God, and they think, oh, God must be really angry at me, I'm sure he's going to, you know, punish me. Remind them, God, the nature of God is to be totally loving and compassionate and forgiving, you know. And the same with Buddha, you know. These holy beings, you know, they don't hold grudges, they don't have anger or hatred or the wish to harm us. So if we genuinely feel regret for the harmful things or negative things that we've done and ask for forgiveness, then definitely, you know, we will be forgiven. And in Buddhism, we have the practice of purification. So if the person is open to that idea, you could guide them or lead them in the practice of purification and really encourage them to feel confident that they have purified whatever wrongs they have done, and so on. So anyway, the point is to, you know, find some skillful and appropriate way to help the person get over such feelings of guilt, of despair, of fear and hopelessness, and instead have a sense of hope that, you know, their sins or negativities can be forgiven, can be purified. Also, it's really helpful to remind them of good things that they did in their life. Sometimes people focus only on the mistakes and the bad things and ignore the positive things. So it's good to remind them of that. You know, oh, you were a good father, you were a good mother, you raised these children, and you, whatever, you know, whatever is appropriate. But, you know, point out the positive things that the person has done and try to help them feel a sense of rejoicing. This is what we call rejoicing in Buddhism, feeling joyful or happy about positive things that we have done as well as positive things that others have done. And then in Buddhism we have this, what we call Buddha nature, meaning the potential to transform ourselves and, you know, be free of all that is negative and develop all that is positive. So Buddhism says everybody, every living being has Buddha nature. So we can all be completely purified and transformed and even Buddha, enlightened. So if the person is open to that idea, you could talk to them about that. Or whatever is appropriate according to their... You do need to be sensitive to the person's beliefs, religious or whatever, spiritual beliefs, and not try to force your beliefs on them. This is really, really, really important. You know, don't try to convert people on the deathbed. That's that's a no-no, according to Buddhism. So try to understand what it is the person already believes, what they have faith in, what kind of practices they have done in their life, and then talk to them in those terms, use those kind of terminology. And if the person is non-religious, if they're a, what do you call it here, free thinker, or even atheist, then you could just try to find some kind of terminology and language. You could use the language of psychology, for example, or whatever would be relevant to them, whatever would make sense to them, you know, to encourage them to think in a positive way and feel good about themselves, feel good about their lives, and feel hopeful about what's coming next. Then, create a peaceful environment. So this is from the advice of Lama Zopa Rinpoche. He said it's really good to, you know, if the person, whether they're in a hospital room or they're at home, try to arrange the environment in a way that's beautiful, inspiring, peaceful. You know, have fresh flowers, because flowers, you know, fresh flowers, you know, just naturally make the mind more happy and comfortable, fresh flowers. And then if the person is a believer, Buddhist or Christian or whatever, have images of whatever, whoever they believe in, that will help them remember their religious beliefs and practices. So if they are Buddhists, you could have images of the Buddha or Kuan Yin, whoever their favorite Buddha may be, images of teachers that they have learned from and are inspired by, and so on. And keep it neat as much as possible, neat and tidy, clean, and yeah, serenity, because they said that having a peaceful and beautiful, inspiring environment can help the person to be in a better state of mind. And then also try to remove any objects that might cause the person's mind to become negative. You know, if they have anger, aversion towards a certain person or a certain object, don't have that picture there, you know, take that one away. Also with attachment, I mean, this is a tricky thing because, you know, people tend to be very attached to other family members and, yeah, the family itself. So attachment, from the Buddhist point of view, attachment is one of the disturbing emotions that can come up at the time of death and cause the mind to be in a not very peaceful state, right? So they actually say when a person is dying, it's not helpful for family members to be there and showing sadness and grief, crying and so forth, because then this can disturb the person's mind. They can feel, oh yes, I'm really sad to be leaving, and look at all the sadness I'm causing others, and so on. So it can, you know, create turmoil in the mind of the person. So again, that's why it's said it's good when you're in the presence of someone who's dying to try not to show sadness, grief, and so on, and instead show feelings of calmness and peace and non-attachment, non-clinging. So I was once with, when I was living here in Singapore, I was asked to go and say prayers for this woman who was dying, and I didn't know her very well, but it was her sister that asked me to go and say prayers. And she was relatively young. I think she was only about 39 when she died. So she had some young children and her husband and other family members there when she was dying. So I was with her at the time of death. And she'd been in a coma, unconscious for some time before she died. So, you know, she was not, you know, in a state of awareness and so on. But the family members were around, and they had her hooked up to one of these machines. I don't know what it's called. It detects the heart rate. You know, what's that called? Anyway, so that was sitting there next to her bed, and so it went flat. You know, it goes flat when the person dies. So when that happened, you know, the family members started making noise, and I said, please, you know, go somewhere else. And they did. I was a little worried they might be upset with me, but they understood and they agreed. So they went out of the room to do their crying and their wailing, and then I stayed with a sister. And, well, it makes sense, doesn't it? I mean, when you're dying and you want to be in a peaceful state of mind, if you have, you know, the sounds of wailing and crying, it makes it hard to be in a peaceful state of mind. So anyway, the sister and I stayed with her and just continued to recite prayers and mantras and so on. But so that's a little bit sensitive. But, you know, if you have any sort of control, or, you know, you're able to manage a situation, then it's good to try to do that. And there was another occasion, another woman who was dying, and she was also relatively young, in her early 40s. And I had been visiting her quite a lot for the last couple of months of her life, and I got to know the family quite well. And I, you know, we would sometimes recite Om Mani Padme Hum together for her. And her last 24 hours, the last 24 hours in the hospital, the family members and friends and so on were taking it in turns to recite Om Mani Padme Hum continuously. So when you walked into this hospital room, it was like a meditation hall. It was like a temple. It was so peaceful and so calm, and there was this continuous sound of Om Mani Padme Hum being recited. Yeah. So that was, I think, a good situation. That's, you know, an ideal way to go. But I also thought, not only is it good for the person who's dying, but I think it's also good for those who are left behind, because then they feel that they are doing something. Because often you feel helpless. You want to help the person who's dying, but you don't know what to do, so you feel kind of helpless. So having, you know, that situation where they were all reciting mantras continuously made them feel they were doing something beneficial for her, for this person they loved very much. And it also helped them to be in a more calm, peaceful state of mind, instead of, you know, afraid and worried and sad and so on. So anyway, when it comes to family and friends, it's good to try to help them understand the importance of keeping the environment calm and peaceful and positive and prayerful, you know, whatever kind of prayers or mantras are appropriate according to the person's beliefs. Yeah, so that's the next point, is try to understand what are the beliefs and practices the dying person is familiar with, and then talk to them accordingly. Again, don't try to convert the person to your views and practices. That would just create confusion in their mind, maybe anger as well. I heard this very sad story. When Venerable Children was in Singapore prior to when I came here, she had one student, a young man, and he was very, very ill, and she was trying to help him as he was getting closer to death. And then suddenly he had to be rushed to the hospital, and she was called, so she went to the hospital to meet him. And when she walked into the room, the doctor was there, and it seems the doctor was trying to convert this young man to Christianity. So this poor young man, he's saying, no, I'm a Buddhist. So she got really upset. She told the doctor to get out of there. So, and anyway, that's, from the Buddhist point of view, that's really inappropriate. I'm sure the doctor meant well, you know, but, you know, from our point of view, we shouldn't try to convert a person, especially at the time of death. We should really try to encourage them, whatever beliefs they have, whatever they find is important and beneficial for themselves, to respect that and talk to them accordingly. So even if you're a Buddhist, but the person who's dying, if they are of another faith, then, you know, be respectful to their faiths. It's not respectful. It's disrespectful to the person, you know, to, you know, say, you're wrong. You should be like this. You should think like that. So, yeah, again, you know, learn what the person believes in and what kind of prayers and practices they do, and then encourage them to remember those things and do those things and even do those prayers and practices with them, because it's beneficial, even if it's not something you believe in, but it's beneficial for the dying person. And that's the most important thing, is benefiting them at that time. Or you could also invite a priest or a rabbi or an imam or whatever, you know, would be able to help that person. And again, if they don't have any religious beliefs, then just you try to find whatever language, whatever terminology would be able to convey the same ideas, to help them be in a positive state of mind. And then last is, you can continue to meditate, pray, recite mantras and so forth during and after the person's death. So according to Buddhism, the actual time of death is when the person's mind leaves the body, which could be some time after the breath has stopped. Like in Western science, Western medicine, the time of death is, I was just checking on this, they say it's the brain death. When the brain is dead, then that's the point at which a person is declared death, because even the heart can still beat, the body can be kept alive, but the person will never be able to, you know, live a normal life after that. So, but according to Buddhism, even after the brain is dead and the breath has stopped and the heart has stopped and everything is shut down, the consciousness, the mind, might still be present in the body, and it could remain there for a number of hours or even days. There's cases, stories of, in the Tibetan tradition, of lamas or meditators who are able to remain in that state. They call it tukdam, even for, you know, 10, 12, 14, 15 days. And the body doesn't decay or start to smell bad. It remains fresh. And then they do talk about signs that occur when the consciousness has left the body so that people can know. So they say there will be some liquid coming out of the nostrils or out of the sexual organ. So that's one sign. Another sign is they say that even if the body is cold, the body gets cold, but there is still a little bit of heat in the area of the heart chakra, not the physical heart, but the heart chakra in the center of the chest. So a little bit of heat there. And again, the body doesn't decompose or smell. So until the signs of death have occurred, they say it's good if you can to just leave the body undisturbed. But as we were saying yesterday, that, you know, could be problematic if the person dies in the hospital. If they're at home, if the person is at home, you can have more control over that, but not in a hospital, because a hospital will have its rules. But anyway, so in Tibetan Buddhism, we can continue to recite prayers, mantras, and do meditation with the body, with the corpse, until the signs of death have occurred. So that could be hours or even days afterwards. And then, as we were saying yesterday, even when the mind has left the body, it could be in this bardo or intermediate state for up to 49 days, 7 weeks after death. So it's customary to continue reciting prayers and dedicating merit for the person during that 49-day period. I think it's the same in Chinese Buddhism, isn't it, that you do prayers for someone who's deceased for 49 days. And it's said that it's particularly good for those who are relatives, who have like a blood connection with the person who's passed away, to do these practices, because you have a stronger karmic connection. So any prayers and merits you create will be more powerful, more effective, more beneficial for the person who has died. But you can also ask others. You can ask monks, nuns, monasteries, and so forth to do prayers. In fact, in our organization, the FPMT, we have... Anyway, you can go online and figure out how to do this, but there's something called Prayers for the Dead. So there's actually a list of people who've died, and then there are people who every day or on a regular basis dedicate prayers for that person who's died. So you can do prayers on your own, you can ask others to do prayers. And you can also do other kinds of practices, such as making offerings, donations. It said if you have access to the money, the property of the person who's passed away, if you have some control over that, you can use some of that money to create merit, like make offerings, donations, charitable donations, and so on. And then dedicate the merit, the good energy, to that person to have a good rebirth. So it's like you're making donations on their behalf. You're creating merit on their behalf. So that could be a good way of benefiting them. Okay, so that's pretty much what I had to say. And I just want to point out, this is another book. You can download it from fpmt.org. It's an ebook, and it's called How to Help Your Loved Ones Enjoy Death and Go Happily to Their Next Rebirth. It's a great title. So it was actually compiled by Venerable Robina Corton, an Australian nun, who does a lot of editing of books and so on. So she just compiled all this material from Lama Zopa Rinpoche and put it together in this book. So And there's a number of other books as well on different prayers and practices. Some of them are quite huge. You know, many, many different prayers and practices that can be done before a person dies, during the death process, and even after they've died. So if you really care about somebody and you want to benefit them in a spiritual way, then there are lots of things that you can do. Okay, so maybe you have some questions. Well, could someone get the microphone and pass it around? Let her go first. She's already standing up. Your what?
My teacher. Her father recently passed away because of wrong medical treatment. So she has been feeling very guilty. And
she's feeling guilty?
Guilty about her role as a daughter. And her mother has dementia. So what happened is the father is still very attached to the family and is visiting the home. So
you're saying the father passed away, but he's still visiting. Oh, you mean the ghost, like. What can we do to move on? This is a little problematic because according to the Tibetan explanation of, you know, the whole process of death, dying, the bardo, and the next rebirth, according to that explanation, once the consciousness of a person has left their body and goes into this intermediate state, the bardo state, they have a form, not a gross form like this, but a subtle form that most people cannot see. But the form that they have is not of the past life, but it's the next life. So, let's say, you know, a man dies, and in his next life, he's going to be born as a girl, okay, as a female. So when his consciousness leaves his present body, it takes this new body, bardo body, but it would be that of a 7-year-old child that will be the next life. So it would be a 7-year-old girl. So that's the form that one has in the bardo. So when people have these experiences of seeing the form of a deceased loved one, like in this case, you know, the father who passed away, and people still see him wandering around. What I've heard, because this question came up before when I was here and lamas were visiting, so what the lamas say is that this is actually a spirit assuming the form of the deceased. Spirits can do that. They can, I don't know, to play tricks or whatever, be mischievous. So they can actually assume the form of someone who's passed away and then sort of hang around. So according to that, I don't know if you want to believe that or not, but according to that explanation, when people are seeing their father who's passed away, it's not actually their father. It's a ghost, it's a spirit. Just assuming that form, pretending to be the father. So I am in no position to say what is the correct view, correct story. But my guess is maybe the problem is that these people, they have attachment to their father. They miss their father so much, wishing that he was still there. And so because of their attachment, then a ghost or a spirit is, you know, coming and, you know, assuming the form of their father. So it's they who need to let go and accept. Does that make sense? I know there are people who do that kind of thing. I haven't been living here for a long time. So if if you do know a reliable person who, you know, has that kind of ability, is able to do that kind of practice, maybe there are monks who can do that, monks and nuns who can do that, then it might be worthwhile, might be helpful to go through such a ritual. You know, maybe a sort of a way to finish this whole situation, and for the family to let go of their father, and also for the spirit to say, okay, I'm not going to hang around anymore. I don't know. I can't say for sure that that would be helpful, but it might be useful just to have closure, like we say in America, to have closure for that whole situation. Yeah.
I wanted to check, because sometimes we have come across inspirational speakers that shared their near-death experience, how they were so close to death, they seen the light at the other end, and they came back to life and they shared their stories. We're not sure how true is it, but how do we... what kind of advice would you give to... When do you make a decision that it's really time for you to go, or you know, that you know you can make a choice and say, no, you want to stay alive, come back to life, and you know, pass on the message?
You're talking about the person who is dying?
Yes.
Do they have any choice?
Yes. Do they have a choice to say that perhaps I'm not ready, or I want to come back?
I don't know. I mean, I have met a few people who've talked to me about their near-death experiences. There was one woman who was in an accident, like a car accident, and was, her body was very, very severely damaged, injured. And she told me that, yeah, she had the experience of leaving her body. And I can't remember exactly what happened. I think either she met some wonderful being, or she just had these wonderful experiences. But she didn't want to come back. She actually did not want to come back, but she did. And I don't know why. You know, karmically, maybe her karma wasn't finished or whatever. But she came back. But yeah, then she had to deal with this very, you know, badly damaged body and having to go through a lot of difficulties with that. So I'm in no position to say, you know, what's going on there, why these things happen to people, why they come back. I mean, there was actually one woman who had really an extraordinary story. I'll tell you the story. She was in Sicily, in Italy. And she said that she and her husband were practitioners of yoga and really tried to live a very pure spiritual life. And she had one child already, and then she got pregnant with a second child. But there were lots of problems with the pregnancy, lots of pain and so on. And then one time she was in the hospital being examined, and the doctor actually discovered that I don't know the term for this, but the fetus was growing outside of the womb. There's a term for that? Huh? Anyway, whatever. That's what was happening. And he said, oh, we have to operate immediately, because otherwise you will die, and also the baby. So she was immediately taken into the operating room, and during the operation, she left her body. And she said she had this amazing experience of going into some other state of whatever other realm and meeting this being, although it wasn't so much something she saw but more felt and heard, but she had this meeting with this very wonderful, loving, compassionate being. And I think she also didn't want to come back. She wanted to stay in this other state, but she was told she had to come back. She still had a baby. She had a, you know, the first child was still very young. So she kind of knew that was the right thing to do, to come back and take care of her first child. So she did come back. And so I guess while she was on the operating table, it appeared as if she died, and her husband was very, very worried, but then she did come back to life. And then the story goes on. She said, you know, after that experience, she and her husband didn't have any sexual relations for the next 6 months, but she got pregnant again. Figure that. And so she had another baby, and she never told the doctors, you know, that this was like immaculate conception, right? that's right. She also said she continued feeling the presence of this being that she had met outside of, you know, when she went out of her body. She felt that being was still around after this experience. So she had this second child, and I said, what kind of child was it? You know, it must have been very special. And I think that by that time the child was already 30. Yeah, she said, yeah, he's quite a special, nothing really, really special or extraordinary, but yeah. So I thought that was an interesting story, right? I don't know if this doesn't really relate to your question so much, but it was... Yeah, interesting. So your question was, do you have a choice about coming back? It sounds like not necessarily. Yeah.
At the hospital bed, sometimes you see family members telling the patient not to give up the fight. So when do we advise them that no, it's okay to let them let go and when not to, because there are cases of, you know, people being in coma for several years and then coming back and sharing their story. So when do we draw the line to say it's okay to just let go?
Yeah, that's a difficult question. I don't know. I mean, I think it's clear that if you know, the person is very elderly, or if the disease has been going on for a long time and is incurable, and lots of things have been already tried, and the doctors said, well, there's really nothing more we can do. So in that kind of situation, then, it is difficult to know, isn't it? But yeah, like you say, there are cases of people who, I was just reading last night on YouTube, there was this boy in America, 15-year-old boy, who was severely injured, head injury, and the doctors declared that he was brain dead, and the parents were ready to sign off his organs, you know, have his organs donated, and then he came back to life. So normally they say, once you're brain dead, that's it, finished, you know. But in this case, you know, he did come back to life. So they say it was a miracle. It was God. God who did this, because normally it doesn't happen. So it's really hard to know. I guess it's good to hang on to some thread of hope and encouragement, but also be prepared that maybe it is time. Yeah, maybe just hold both of those two things in mind and be ready for whatever happens. But yeah, this is one of the difficult situations, you know, how long to keep somebody alive artificially. I mean, sometimes people, they themselves say, I don't want to be kept alive. Are you allowed to do that in Singapore? They call it a advanced directive. Hmm? Yeah. So people can make that kind of declaration that they do not wish to be kept alive artificially. So if that's been written, then yeah, that makes it clear to the family and the doctors and so on. So, I don't know, I'm not a medical practitioner, so I'm not in that situation of having to make these sort of decisions, but it must be really difficult sometimes. So, any other questions? Oh, yeah. Where's the microphone?
Here.
Oh, I thought there was one down here and one up there. You can take this one.
Can I ask?
Oh, you, follow-up? Okay, and then... You first and then him.
Okay. Actually, two questions. So Buddhism makes a distinction between the mind and the brain. So when someone has lost their mind, as in neurologically damaged, in a coma, etc., but not really brain dead yet.
Oh, no, 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 no. That's not true. Even if somebody's in a coma, they haven't lost their mind, according
right.
to Buddhism. Their mind is still there.
So if someone is psychotic or has some kind of dementia, neurologically impaired, is that saying that we begin this to assist in this dying process a little earlier? Because if they have no longer in possession of their mind.
Well, yeah, I mean, we do have this expression in English, somebody losing their mind, but I think that means their mind has become damaged or mentally ill. But according to Buddhism, mind is still there in the body, even in the case of a coma, even in the case of dementia, psychoses, all these kinds of mental illnesses. The mind is still there, it's still present, still existing, still experiencing things, even though they may be distorted things. So Buddhism says we only lose our mind when the mind exits the body after death. I mean, after the breath has stopped and so on. So, the mind continues to be present in the body, continues to have experiences until it has exited. And then I mentioned what are the signs to know that the mind has actually exited the body. So that's why, you know, we do need to treat a person, a body, carefully and respectfully until the mind has left. So what was the question?
Because you mentioned earlier that death happens when the mind separates from the body. So if the mind is fragmented or impaired but not separated from the body, it's still not dying yet.
Mm.
So at what stage do we prepare the dying process, or help with the dying process? Can we start it a little earlier because the person might no longer be able to comprehend and absorb what you're saying? So,
well, even in the case of a coma, when a person is in a coma and they show no signs of awareness of the outside world, it seems that they can still know and hear and understand things that are going on around them. You've heard of stories like that, right? Somebody comes out of a coma and they talk about things that happened while they were in the coma. So even though from our point of view, it seems like the person's not really there, not really aware, but they are still aware. So in terms of someone who's dying, that's why it's said that it's good to continue reciting prayers and mantras and so on and so forth, even if the person is unconscious. Right up to the time when the mind leaves the body, you can continue to recite prayers and do these positive actions.
Can I ask a follow-up question? And that is, if compassion is the bedrock of Buddhism, what does, for someone who's gone through a lot of surgery, multiple accidents, a lot of suffering physically and emotionally and mentally is pretty much absent. What does Buddhism have to say about something like euthanasia?
Yeah, normally it's not. It's not something that we would do in Buddhism. That's my understanding. Yeah, because it's killing. Yeah, to end a life before it ends naturally would be killing. And I don't know if there would be exceptions to that. Well, if the person themselves had specified that they do not want to be kept alive on machines, yeah, if they have said, don't keep me alive, just let me go, if they have said that, then, you know, it's okay to turn off the machines and not artificially keep them alive. But to induce death by injection or, I don't know, whatever means they use, that would be considered killing or suicide if the person themselves says, I want you to give me an injection, and that would be suicide, which is still a form of killing. So traditionally in Buddhism, this is not something recommended. But yeah, I'm sure there's lots of debate about that and different points of view. So you had a question?
It's a bit of follow-up from yesterday's question about at the point of death. In some religion, they believe that when they pass away, they will go to heaven and all the sins will be forgiven. So they are very peaceful. But for Buddhists, I mean for myself, it's like, what, there's karma, there's a lot of... So it's like we don't know where we are going. And then at the deathbed, it's like, should I think that we should pray to go Pure Land, where at least it's like, ultimately we'll go to Nirvana, or we should let nature take its own course. So my question is, should we like aspire to go somewhere, or we just aspire that there will be Dharma when we are around? I mean, we'll be reborn in the realm where there's Dharma. Or should we just say that, let's go Amitabha, then at least it won't fail. You know, it's like we go for exam, at least we go Amitabha, we won't fail. It's like sooner or later we'll pass.
Yeah. Well, we were talking about this yesterday, you know, what should we aspire for? And there are, you know, different ideas, different points of view. Either you can ask your teacher, or you yourself can decide where you would like to go and then create the causes to go to that place, such as Amitabha's Pure Land. So it's really up to you, how, you know, what you want to do. But it is said that in the Lamrim teachings, it said that one of the benefits of refuge, taking refuge, is that we won't go to an unfortunate rebirth in our next life. So if at the time of death we are able to take refuge, even if just to remember one Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha or Kuan Yin, or, you know, one of the objects of refuge, and, you know, take refuge and ask for help and guidance and so on, then that will guarantee, like with the Christians, you know, guarantee that we won't go to a bad rebirth in that next life, and instead go to some good place, either come back as a human being or go to one of the Deva realms, the heavens, and so on. So that's, I think of that as like the bottom line, okay? At the very least, we should aspire to or try to have that in our mind. If it's hard to feel love, hard to feel compassion, hard to remember emptiness, hard to meditate on the clear light, okay, those are pretty advanced practices that might be hard to do at the time of death. But I think taking refuge isn't that hard to do, you know, especially if you have a picture or an image or a statue of the Buddha there, you know, next to your bed when you're dying, and just really pray, please, Buddha, help me, take care of me, help me go to a good place where I can continue to practice and so on and so forth. So at the very least, this is what we should aspire for, taking refuge.
The second question is, yesterday after lunch, when Brother led us through the death meditation, so I feel a bit scared after the whole thing. So is it... So my question is this fear normal, and how to overcome this fear? It's like near-death experience where you some sort of see myself, it's like out of the body, and I mean, there's some realization in terms of like emptiness, attachment, but on the other hand, there's fear. That means quite scary. And instead, the process of death, it's like what we will see, the process as we die, on the process, will we see certain images, certain steps of all the four elements releasing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that explanation, it was the eight stages? Yeah. So that explanation of the eight stages is found in the Vajrayana teachings. I don't think it's found in any of the other traditions of Buddhism. And it's really meant to, it's part of Vajrayana practice. When you're doing that kind of practice, you sort of train in being familiar with those eight stages so that when you're going through them, you can recognize, now I am at this stage, now I am at that stage. And then there are certain practices to do while you're in those stages. But I think one needs to be quite, you know, accomplished in meditation to be able to actually recognize and practice as you're going through those stages. So that's why I say, you know, those of us who aren't so accomplished in meditation, at least if before we die, before we stop breathing, if we can remember to take refuge and really pray very hard to whatever Buddha we're able to think of and feel, you know, confident in at that time, then, you know, even if we're confused as we go through the eight stages and the bardo and so on, then, you know, it's the last moment before we die. That's the most important one. That's the crucial one. That's the one that will determine our next life, our next rebirth. So if we can aim to have a positive state of mind, such as taking refuge, feeling love and compassion at that time, then that's said to guarantee that the next life, the next rebirth will go well. And as for images or experiences that can occur during the stages of death and the bardo, well, that really depends on what we do with our life. And that's why it's so important that we try to do as much good deeds, virtuous deeds, and avoid negative ones as much as we can. Because what we are familiar with, what we are habituating ourselves to during our life will naturally be the cause for the experiences we have during that time. For example, in the Lam Rim, they tell this story about this man in Tibet who used to kill a lot of sheep. He was like a butcher of sheep. So before he died, he had this image of a huge stampede of sheep coming at him and, you know, running over him, and it was very frightening and very disturbing. But you can see the connection, yeah? He killed many sheep, and now all these sheep are coming and, you know, running over him. So, you know, in a similar way, if during our life we're trying to help people and be kind and avoid harmful things like killing and instead, you know, give, you know, to those who are in need and help those who are in need and so forth and do other kinds of prayers and practices, you know, such as purification and visualizing Buddhas and so forth. And we're making those kind of imprints in our mind. And that's going to be what's most prominent or dominant in our mind during our life. So then that's what will come up at the time of death. So it doesn't help to be afraid. I mean, it is understandable, but it's good to try to develop a sense of confidence, you know, that, you know, as long as I'm living a good life and doing good things and making good aspirations for the future, then that's as much as I can do. I am doing my best.
Hello.
Oh, okay. Venerable, I have a question on Powa. When, say, a loved one passed away, and so we got a high master to do Powa for the loved one. So what happened is that if the Lama is not with the body, but it's some overseas or something, and he's doing it sort of like long distance, so does the family continue to recite mantra or just leave the room and keep the place quiet until the powa is completed?
You mean at the actual time when this lama who is in another country is doing the powa? I don't know. I never thought of that. I don't really know. I mean, I'm sure it's okay for you to continue doing your prayers and mantras. I don't think that would interfere with the poa practice that the Lama is doing, because he's somewhere else doing his practice. But maybe you can just do it a little more quietly. I don't know. That's just a guess. Okay, but I really don't know for sure. Yeah,
because that question sort of come to me when my dad passed on. I wasn't sure whether I should continue to recite mantra or I should just leave the room and be quiet. But at the end, we choose to just leave the room and then let the powa continue until, you know, the master called me and say he has finished doing the powa.
I'm sure either way is okay, because during that time when the Lama was doing the powa, he was helping the person. So even if you were not there reciting your prayers, he was getting the help that he needed.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Sorry, according to what disease?
Quantum physics.
Oh, quantum physics. I don't understand the question. Quantum physics? What does that have to do with it?
According to quantum physics, there's this theory that what we think will then be materialized. So if you think about empty stuff, if you focus on empty stuff, then everything can be realized. So if based on this theory, some people are afraid that
that if you think about death, then will death come sooner than planned? And should they focus more on focus their energy on thinking about healing, or should they focus on thinking about how to die? Is that what you want to say? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I don't know if that theory is really true. I mean, the reality is we are going to die one day. And if we think, okay, I'm never going to think about death, because if I think about death, it's going to happen. So I'm never going to think about death. And if you think that by doing that, you're never going to die, is that realistic? No. Okay. So whether we think about it or we don't think about it, we are definitely going to die one day. So the point of thinking about death is not to be worried and, you know, like that, but just to be aware. It's the reality. Our body, every single moment, is getting older and closer to death. That's just the reality. We can't stop it, you know. Even if we put all thoughts of death out of our mind, there's no way we can avoid it. So the point of thinking about death is simply to be aware that it's going to happen so that we're ready for it when it does happen. And what we need to do to be ready for death when it happens is to do as much positive things as possible. So really we are focusing on doing positive things, having positive thoughts, love, kindness, compassion, doing positive things, benefiting others, and so on. So the main focus isn't just to say, I'm going to die, but rather to focus on doing what will be useful and beneficial to us when we die, with that awareness that death could happen at any moment. Because otherwise, if we never think about death, we could be caught unawares and maybe in a bad state of mind, which we definitely don't want to happen. Okay, so very good questions, but we need to stop now, come to the end of our time. So I hope this has been beneficial for you. You have learned some things, and there's a lot more to learn, but you know, there are other sources, books, other courses, and so on, to learn more about this subject. So the most important thing, again, is to keep our mind and our actions as positive as we can, do as much good as we can, try to avoid doing things that are harmful or negative, but even if we do, we can always purify. There's always that practice of purification to clear up the negative things that we've done. Yeah. So, and also to have confidence, you know, confidence in our positive abilities, our potential, the good things that we do, and confidence that if we continue going in this direction, then things will go well. We will have a peaceful death and a good rebirth and be able to continue in our spiritual practice into the future. So let's make a dedication of the good energy, the positive energy that we've created here today, coming together, generating a positive, altruistic motivation, and then doing meditation, listening, discussing these points, and so on. So we've created good energy, merit. So now we can share that merit with others, with the wish that it will bring peace, happiness, freedom from suffering, and ultimately enlightenment to ourselves and everyone else. Thank you. Best wishes.
Yes. Good afternoon, brothers and sisters from the Sangha Kadra. Just like to say a few words that reflect to see how fortunate we are this time in Singapore to have been able to invite Venerable Sangha Kadra to be here for the last 4 weeks to share with us the precious teachings of the Buddha Dharma. I think quite often in life, we just go on and just keep on moving and without stopping to reflect, to think, what are the real realities of life and issues like living and dying, what we've Sangha Kadra shared with us over this weekend. I think it's something all of us will have to face one day. And so we at Amitabha Buddhist Center here really feel very fortunate that we're able to invite Sangha Kadra, who was really, really very well qualified, a scholar, practitioner, and a long time Sangha. I think 50 years now, Veral?
No.
45. Close enough. That's, I think, close enough.
Close.
Half a century.
If I live another 5 years, then it'll be 50.
So, on behalf of all the members of ABC here, Venerable, we'd like to say a very, very big thank you And really, 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 we really deeply, really appreciate you taking the time to come to Singapore to share with us the precious words of the Dharma, and really planting these precious seeds of the Buddha's teachings in our mind that we become the cause for enlightenment. Thank you very much, Venerable. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd like to present a token of appreciation on behalf of the center to Venerable here.
Made here? Is it, are these made here? Or?
The casing, the brass casing, was made in China, and we filled it with the many Bengal mantras and microfilm, and four Dhammakaya relic mantras as well. So I believe it's about 500 million.
Wow.
Yes, so this prayer wheel has been put together and is advised by Lama Zopa Rinpoche in this traditional way with the lotus mantra, the tree of life in the center, and the microfilm Om Mani Padme Hum mantras, and wound in a special way that when you turn it, it always turns clockwise. So one turning is good in reciting the mantra maybe 500 million times.
So this is very easy to do, you know, even if you're sick or if you're, you know, your mind has gone crazy, you can just sit there. Yes. Yeah. Well, this is what Tibetans do, you know, elderly Tibetans, you know, they don't just sit in front of the television all the time, but they're, you know, turning their prayer wheels, reciting their mantras. They keep creating merit, right, up until the end. When their bodies are very old, but they still do these practices. So, good example.
Also, just to share, there's quite a few people who actually have come to ABC to buy these prayer wheels for their loved ones who are departing beside the hospital bed, and so they can actually continue to turn the prayer wheels until the very last breath. So we do have a stock of them upstairs as well. So. Real small commercial, yeah. Thank you anyway. So thank you all very much. Really appreciate that you've taken the time to come and to ABC to listen to the precious teachings of the Dharma as taught by Verma Sangye Khandro here. And we really will try and put together more similar programs in the future. And on behalf of the members of Verma Sangye Khandro, can we invite you back next year?
Well, I have a previous commitment, but maybe the following year. We'll see. We'll see how things go.
Okay, then. Thank you very much. Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, so I'm leaving on Tuesday morning, very early in the morning, so I don't recommend coming to the airport, but we do have a puja this evening, 4:30 till 6:30 or so. There's a Lama Chöpa Guru Puja. So if you're coming to that, we can see each other there. And then there's the dinner afterwards, so we can still meet again this evening. But otherwise, thank you and goodbye and next time. And also, as I mentioned yesterday, whatever offerings I get today, I'll be giving to Amitabha Buddhist Center. So you can also just, you know, if you want to make an offering, just put it right into the donation box. But it's also completely non-obligatory. You don't need to offer anything. Because, you know, in the Lam Rim, they say the best offering to make to a teacher is to practice, to put into practice what the teacher teaches. That's the thing that's most beneficial for you and also for the teacher. The teacher really wants to see people practicing, so that's the best offering you can make. Thank you.